Good morning and welcome to the April 21st edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on this not-so-spring-like day. Last day the PCMR is going to be open.
Yeah, that is true. Good morning, everyone.
We got a good show this morning. We're going to start by speaking with Jan Olpen. She's the owner of that Heber mainstay, the Dairy Queen. Then we'll speak with Jessica McCleary. She's the owner of Mountain Town Olive Oil. We're going to ask her about how current trade uncertainty is affecting her business. We'll finish our hour by spending time with author Stephen Witt. He's going to discuss his new book about NVIDIA founder Jensen Huang. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money.
Okay, restaurants come and go, but the Dairy Queen in Heber has been a constant for many years. Joining us to talk about live from the restaurant as the baking is being cooked to prep us for the day is owner Jan Olpen. Thanks for making time for us. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning. How are you guys?
We are doing extremely well. How's the bacon coming there?
It is frying up.
Beautiful. Okay. Hey, let's start with a bit of history. When did the restaurant open, please?
Well, this restaurant opened in 1968. It was originally a Dairy Queen. We changed the QU to a K because we didn't want to be a franchise. First day in business, we made $300, which was a lot of money in 1968. Now, so here we are.
Now, that's this restaurant. There's some history that goes before that, though, doesn't there? Isn't there?
Yes. My family started in business in 1946.
Holy
cow. That is 78 years. My grandparents sold everything they had to go into business. So, I mean, everything. Their car, their china, their silverware. They sold everything.
And what was that first business?
It was first called the Highway Motel and Restaurant. And it is where the, well, we have a lot of them now, but it's where the car wash is on 2nd North.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So...
And so then that evolved, when did that evolve into the Dairy Queen franchise?
1968, but we also built another motel in 1957. So we still own that. That is the Swiss Alps Inn, and it's next door to the Dairy Queen.
Oh, interesting. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
And so when did you sell the car wash property, that hotel?
Probably about 1969.
Okay, right after Dairy Queen, okay.
So flash forward, yep. you originally open as a Dairy Queen. You conclude you don't want to be a franchise.
Right.
I'm a little surprised that those high-paid lawyers at Dairy Queen would sort of be satisfied with just changing the name, the QU to a K.
The funny part is the only thing they cared about was on the sign, on the original sign, was a giant ice cream cone. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to make sure that we took the curl, which was their trademark, was the curl off of the sign. So we climbed on up, painted that over too, and they didn't care after that.
Just a couple of bucks of paint saved you from a lot of
it was
lawyers.
Kind of crazy.
Nice. Now, did you keep the little curl on the end of the ice cream when you served it?
Yeah, it kind of just naturally happens that way.
Oh, wonderful.
Go ahead. So, Jan, the obviously ice cream and the shakes are a mainstay, and we're going to get to some more conversation about the menu. But the other thing that the Keen is so well known for is the train. How did the trains come to, be part of the restaurant lore?
In about 1970, my father went to a restaurant in California, and they had a train in the ceiling. So he thought that would be an awesome idea because we had the Heber Valley Railroad. At that time, it was called the Heber Creeper. And so we put it up in the ceiling in our old building. We have since rebuilt the building. We did that in 1998 in time for the Olympics. My goodness, my brain's not quite awake this morning. So we had the train in the old building, and then we moved it on over to the new building. We had an artist come in and put in background, and it's just amazing. It's the Heber Valley.
Does that look like the Heber Valley Creeper? The train? I'm thinking about the train. I hadn't really focused on it.
Well, we have different trains. Ah. We have 19 different engines. We have a Disney train. We have a train that looks a lot like the Heber Valley Railroad trains.
Mm-hmm.
They are all made in Germany. They're LGB trains, and they last the longest. They have actual metal parts. They aren't just made with plastic. So they chug along our ceiling.
Nice.
Every day.
Now, I know many young people in the area had their first job at the Dairy Queen. Have you ever had of former employees come back and work at the restaurant?
My goodness, we've not only have children, we have grandchildren. So it's like my grandma worked here, or my great grandma. We even have some of those that, and we have in our hallway, we have a list of all the employees we've had. I'm a little behind on that, but it lists all the employees we've had here. And it lists them by first name because a lot of great grandchildren don't know what Grandma Jane's last name was when she worked here. So
now, how
we have a lot of employees.
How about celebrities? A lot of celebrities come through the place?
We do. We do have a lot of celebrities. The first celebrity that I really have a memory of was Robert Redford came when he was filming Jeremiah Johnson.
Okay.
So that was a long time ago. And they would leave the bear parked out front in a cage and come in and eat.
That's perfect.
So that was kind of fun. And we also have had... Doug Seuss is a bear, is a wildlife trainer, and he lives here in Heber, and he trains bears for movies. And so if you go to Growing Up Grizzly, you'll see him bring, it's a documentary, and he brings his bear here and feeds him hamburgers and ice cream.
Oh, that's where that's happened. I've seen that years ago. That's
yeah, cool. that was lots of fun. But we did find out that bears are kind of lactose intolerant, so we gave him way too much ice cream. So.
Oh.
We're not going to question that one further.
We're gonna move on from that. How about love connections? Have there been any interesting love connections, marriages?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. We've had, I think, 12 employees marry each other, 12 different couples.
So 24
we've
employees.
We've also had some strange wedding proposals. We had a young man come in and he wanted us to put the ring into an ice cream cone. And so we put it into the ice cream cone and they drove away and she was licking the ice cream cone and she sensed his nervousness and she was getting nervous. And so she went to throw the ice cream cone out. She didn't want to eat the cone and she went to throw it out the window. So he pulled over and no. And they found the ring and lived happily ever after.
Oh, perfect.
We had somebody else come in and propose in front of our Coke machines, which I don't know. Is that romantic? I don't know.
In a corporate kind of way.
We've had weddings actually performed here. Some people had met here. So they had a wedding on a Sunday and had their wedding here.
So, Jan, you've received a number of Best of Utah awards over the years, and I know you had a number of them this year. Can you share a little bit, want to brag a little bit about the kind of recognition that this extraordinary restaurant gets?
Well, we are so honored to be honored with Best of State. We have been honored with Best of State since its inception in 2003. So that's 22 years. We've won at least one award every single year. We have... this year we have won 5 awards. We've won for best shakes. We've won for best soup, which I'm extremely proud of because all of our soups are made in the winter and I make all of those. We've won best specialty menu, which is our gluten-free menu, which my sister and I both have celiac. So we have an extensive gluten-free menu. We won for best burger this year. We've worked really hard to get that best burger award back again. It's been a few years since we got that. And then we won best fast food restaurant in the entire state, which we're extremely excited about because that's all of these 5 are really quite an honor to get.
Absolutely. Huge honor. Huge honor.
Let's talk a little bit about the scope of the menu, just for people who haven't had the wonderful experience of checking out your ice cream or your milkshakes. Give us a little bit about what are your mainstays?
Well, we serve burgers, but we have a lot of different burgers. We have a pastrami burger. We have a train burger. Now, a train burger is a quarter-pound hamburger with ham, Swiss American cheese, Thousand Island dressing, lettuce, tomato, and pickle, all on a sesame seed bun. And I can say that faster if it weren't so early in the morning. We also have a bacon cheese, and we fry our bacon every morning. In fact, I'm smelling it right now. We go through a lot of bacon. We go through about between 30 and 90 pounds of bacon a day. So that's kind of crazy. We have chicken and fish and chips. We have some amazing salads. And of course, we're famous for those awesome shakes.
Excellent. Now, what do you do? So all these awards, all these years of being in business, what is your secret? What do you do to maintain business?
I think the most important thing that you do in being in a restaurant is you have to pay attention to what the market is. In 1968, when we opened, the largest hamburger we had was a quarter pounder, but no one bought it because at that time that was so big. Why would you eat that much food? Our drinks at that time, the largest drink we had was a 16-ounce drink. And shakes at that time were thin. So if we had stayed doing status quo, we would not be in business now because everything changes so quickly. And every year we're always looking for new and different things that we can be doing.
Good. And you've remodeled, I assume, changed the place around?
Oh, yes. Yes. So we remodeled the old building 13 times. And the 14th time we started over, we've been in this building since 1998, and we've rebuilt, we've added on or changed this building 4 times since then. So we're always looking at, you know, how can we enlarge this? How can we make this more smooth transition to how it's flowing?
The Dairy Keen is a restaurant that is not to be missed in Heber. Which block are you on?
Jan. We're at 199 South Main.
Okay. Jan Open, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
As shifts in economic policy in this country continue to roil the markets, indeed, I'm seeing the Dow is now down a cool 911 points so far already this morning.
Yikes.
We continue to explore how changes in tariff policy are affecting local businesses. Today, we're joined by Jessica McLaren. She's the owner of Mountain Town Olive Oil. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Jessica, before we get into how all these things are affecting your business, can you just explain a little bit about your business?
So, I own a Mountain Town Olive Oil. We've been in business for 15 and a half years here in Park City. We specialize in gourmet olive oils and balsamic vinegars, have an array of gourmet foods, spices, and home decor and gifts.
And one thing is, Kevin and I were getting ready to go on the program. He said to me, do you know the difference between different kinds of olive oil? And I said, I don't, but she does. And if we ask her that question, she'll be really happy.
Yes, I have a little soapbox I like to stand on. Extra virgin olive oil is the best kind of olive oil for you. It's full of antioxidants and anti-inflammatories. People like to take a shot of it in the morning sometimes if they have arthritic issues or inflammation in the digestive system. Mm-hmm. It's been proven to reduce your risk of heart attack and stroke, reduces high cholesterol. It's just a really great fat for your diet. That's one of the reasons the Mediterranean diet is so popular.
I've heard people take a shot of that at bedtime.
Yeah. It's nature's Advil.
And Jessica, just before we move into the trade routes, can you just explain a little bit about what the difference is between the olive oil that I will get when I go and get some out of one of those interesting bins at your store and the one I'll get at the supermarket?
Studies have shown that between 60 and 70% of olive oil that's imported into this country is fraudulent. It's the most highly adulterated food product to come into the United States. And that basically means that of any given bottle at the grocery store, you know, maybe a quarter of it will be extra virgin olive oil and the rest could be older olive oils or lesser quality olive oils or even vegetable oils that have been flavored and treated to taste like olive oil. And because most Americans don't have the knowledge of what a really good olive oil tastes like, they assume that this plastic chemical thing that they get at the grocery store is what olive oil should taste like. So
that extra virgin label that I see at the grocery store, I shouldn't really have a lot of confidence in it.
I wouldn't.
Okay. No kidding.
Yeah.
So it's all the benefits of extra virgin olive oil. What about regular virgin olive oil or just regular olive oil? Why would anyone buy that?
Price, maybe?
Okay.
You know, ultimately, extra virgin olive oil is the first pressing of the olives.
Is that what that means?
Yeah. The mush in the malaxer gets pressed again and again, it's like lower grades of olive oil, and so less nutritional benefit.
Now, you've mentioned that you've been in this business for a number of years. You clearly have developed supply lines.
Yes.
Vendors. What percentage of what you sell in the, let's start with the olive oils. What percentage of it is imported?
100%.
Okay. And do you have different vendors that you deal with that you import through?
I use one distributor who has been in the olive oil business for over 100 years. They're the country's largest importer of olive oil. And they supply stores like mine around the country. They import in the northern from the northern hemisphere from like November through about February, and from the southern hemisphere from June till, you know, September. So every once in a while we'll get a good California olive oil, but other than that, every single one comes from overseas.
And gotcha. Again, from so both northern and southern hemisphere. So they're importing from probably, you know, probably more than 30 countries.
Yeah, Australia, Chile is where we get a lot of our southern hemisphere oils from, Peru. One time we had it from South Africa. We've had olive oils from New Zealand, and that's all going to be coming in this summer. And then starting in December, we'll get some from Spain, Italy, Greece,
no
Portugal.
Kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't know the southern hemisphere had olive oil here.
Australian olive oils are some of the best in the world. Well, it's one of my
that.
Favorite things.
Now, do you label, I'm visualizing the store, and there are obviously lots of different marvelous flavors that are in the olive oils, but I'm not remembering a lot of country labeling.
Not on the individual bottles, but on the big containers.
On the big containers, it'll tell me what country
it is. Of the unflavored extra virgin olive oils.
But for those of you who've never been there, the store is a lot of fun to walk through because it's sort of the olive oil equivalent of one of those candy stores that has every different candy you can think of.
I love that.
Obviously, we want to talk to you a little bit about how the current trade uncertainty is starting to affect the business. What have you seen so far, if anything?
Over the last couple of weeks, I have received emails from a vendor a day. And, you know, half of my store, if you realize, is, you know, gifts and home decor. All of those are imported. So every single vendor is emailing to announce what their tariff policy is going to be. And a lot of them are trying to absorb the tariffs, but some of them, you know, you can't absorb 145% tariffs and keep your prices low. So those will be passed on to me.
And those will be passed on to us, I assume. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to. Well, who's looking at numbers that big?
Anything from the home goods from China, for example. I'm mostly concerned, though, about the glass that we sell our olive oils in. Our glass bottles are all made in China.
Yeah.
My importer, you know, brings them in by the container or multiple containers, so we might be good for a while, but there's no guarantee that that's going to continue to be the case. The glass bottles that we put our spices in, everything.
Now, speaking of the glass bottles, a friend of mine came over for dinner one time. I was cooking, and I grabbed some extra virgin olive oil. But it was in a plastic container, and she said, "What?
Ouch!
What?" So it's supposed to be in glass or steel. Like I get tins.
Tins are great. You want it to be safe from light and heat. So dark glass, ideally, like a clear glass, will still let in light, and that degrades the olive oil a little faster.
Okay. So are people considering like trying to get a large quantities imported and warehousing it? I mean, are there sort of defensive maneuvers like that?
For sure, but. You know, for me, as a small business, I can't order in 20 pallets of bottles because the storage expense would be astronomical. So one way or the other, the price is going to go up. There's just that balance, and I don't know where that is.
And again, I know that you know, a lot of what you do, because I know I've done this, is, you know, holiday gifts. Right, and what are we're almost in May.
Yeah.
Are you sort of, isn't this the time of year that you're trying to anticipate what you're going to need to sell for the holidays and get it in stock?
Definitely. I try to kick that count down the road as far as I can because the holidays can be so overwhelming.
Right.
But this year, for sure, I'm definitely planning orders out, trying to figure out what I'm going to need. But again, the storage space versus the cost of getting it in and paying for it now and not knowing how the consumer is going to react on top of it, because I could stockpile all of this stuff, and if people are not spending money and all the retail blackouts that we've been seeing, there's a consideration there of, is there any point to stockpiling things if people aren't going to buy it, even if it's a good price? I don't know. And that's the problem I think a lot of small businesses have, because we're stuck in this middle ground of trying to plan for business that we've had, but not knowing what the business is going to be like in the future.
And that, so because you don't know what it's going to cost, you don't know what you're going to be able to charge. So you're really dealing with two problems that are very interrelated. One is, how is the consumer going to react to things like the market going down 950 points?
Mm-hmm.
And what are your prices, what are you going to be paying, which will in turn determine what you can charge.
Yeah.
So you've got a double whammy here. Makes you stay up at night, I bet.
Yeah, my sleep app is definitely showing a lot of wakeful periods, that's for sure.
Okay. And what can you do? All you can do is sort of, you're getting these emails. I guess all you can do is prepare the orders that you can afford to stockpile,
yeah.
And that's about it.
Yeah, I've had a lot of vendors tell me that orders taken by May 1st, prices will be honored, and after that. So, you know, do I spend $10,000 right now?
Yep.
In the hope that people come in and buy it later? Who knows?
Before we go, I do want to take 30 seconds for you to walk around the store with us virtually and talk a little bit about, because Kevin's never been there, talk a little bit about what you see when you go in there, because it's a lot of fun.
Well, I think it's a wonderful store. I think it's, like you said, a little candy store. I know for first-timers, a lot of times it can be overwhelming because we have over 50 flavors of oils and vinegars, but we always encourage people to take their time and just really browse and experience everything. And we're always there to offer samples and taste combinations, and it's really fun for people to figure out what they like.
There are these giant, copper? These giant metal?
They're stainless steel.
There's giant stainless steel containers that you can, you know, that you take it from. And then you put it into those glass bottles for people.
Yeah, we store all of our inventory in those.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can bottle on demand. Like people, we have four different sizes of bottles. A lot of times people come in and bring in their old bottles and we refill for a discount.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, which is actually our promotion this week for Earth Day. Earth Day's tomorrow. So we're offering one free refill per customer.
Now, can we buy that whole stainless steel thing?
No, you don't.
I've had customers buy them, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you use so much olive oil. Does it go bad?
It'll go bad in about a year. But, you know, hopefully if you cook a lot at home, then that should be the right amount.
And Jessica, in the past, you guys have done some cooking classes. Are you still doing that?
Unclear right now.
Okay.
Trying to pivot a little bit to different events in the store, but we are trying to focus more on in-store education.
Education.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So Olive Oil 101 classes and things like that.
Okay, website is?
MountaintownOliveOil.com. We're open daily 10 to 6.
All right, we've been talking to Jessica McCleary about the challenges being faced by at least one small business. We'll be doing more small businesses in weeks to come as we examine sort of the impact of what's going on in our markets. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
When you sit down with your 12-year-old nephew to play a little Xbox, it seems perfectly normal for the bad guys to smoothly explode in bright colors when you hit them. And even the Park City Folly seems to take the technology behind AI somewhat for granted. But it emphatically has not always been so. And much of that technology really comes from one company, NVIDIA. Author Stephen Witt explores how a company that began making chips for gamers really led us to the dawn of AI in his new book, The Thinking Machine. Jensen Huang, NVIDIA, and the world's most coveted microchip. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Steve. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Steve, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Yeah, so just like everyone else, I was astonished by ChatGPT and these kind of new AI systems coming online in 2022. And I said to myself, how is this possible? How is this possible? And the neural network side of it, the software side, OpenAI and all those guys had been pretty well covered. But there was this whole back end, this whole kind of revolution in the way that a computer was built from the circuits up, the hardware side of it. And then really, that was just one company. That was NVIDIA. NVIDIA had built all of the AI hardware. So it took me about a year to write this book. And in the year that I was researching and writing them, they became the most valuable company on the planet. Simply because of their almost monopolistic position on this AI hardware. So it's a fascinating story.
So I imagine during that 1 year of research, the technology changed a couple of times.
Yeah, it was evolving very rapidly. NVIDIA started out, as you mentioned, making kind of controllers for video games.
Yeah.
They made the brain of the Nintendo Switch at one point. But now they build these giant racks of computers in what are called data centers. So it's basically like an airplane hangar full of computing equipment. And when you punch in a request to ChatGPT, like write me a term paper or, you know, tell me, you know, do this thing for me, you know, turn me into like an avatar, an anime person or whatever, that request is taken to one of those data centers on a broadband pipe and processed on NVIDIA chips. So the average person who's using AI is using NVIDIA equipment all the time, although they probably don't realize it.
And are NVIDIA chips still pretty ubiquitous, even in some of its original applications, like graphics accelerators and PCs and things like that?
Yeah, they remain the primary vendor of what are called like graphics processing units for basically like gaming hot rodders. Mm-hmm. So people who sort of build their whole computer around this NVIDIA engine, just like a hot rodder would build a whole car around a powerful engine. Just so they can game at the highest possible resolution. This was something NVIDIA saw very early, that the demand for better 3D graphics from a certain kind of customer was infinite. No matter how good the graphics you supplied them were, they'd always demand more. And that has also proven true for intelligence. It's also proven true for AI. And that's why the company's so big.
And let's go back, though. Let's talk a little bit about the Jensen Huang's childhood and his education, because I think it's actually a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, so Jensen founded this company. He co-founded it, one of the three original co-founders, and he has run it for 32 years. Ooh. He is now the single longest-serving tech CEO in the S&P 500. So this is Jensen's baby. Jensen was born in Taiwan, and he moved to the United States when he was about 10 years old. And he actually arrived ahead of his parents. And his parents thought that they were putting him in like a prestigious preparatory school in Kentucky. But it turned out to be a juvenile reform academy for delinquents, for like bad kids, right? So he shows up to this place and the whole campus is covered with cigarette butts.
Holy cow.
And he kind of goes into his roommate's room and his roommate lifts up his shirt and he shows him the places that he's been stabbed. It's like a recent knife fight. So Jensen was thrown into this very tough, chaotic environment. He was probably the only Asian American around, except for him and his brother, for about 500 miles in any direction. You know, everyone else is white. They're all poor. They're children of tobacco farmers. They're children of coal miners. And Jensen amazingly thrives in this environment. He does great. He ends up being a leader at the school. I mean, he's bullied a lot, and there's a lot of racism. But ultimately, he ends up having one of the best, what he called kind of one of the formative experiences of his life. You know, Jensen had always been a very good student. He got great grades. He got great test scores, et cetera. But now he's in an environment with no rules. No rules at all. And he manages to thrive there, too. And that's sort of what the business world is like. The things that make you succeed in academics don't make you succeed in business.
You know, as I was reading this part of the book, I had like Dickensian visions of this, you know, poor little 10-year-old who barely speaks the language being sent to Kentucky. And I guess what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, because he goes on. Talk a little bit about his academic career after Kentucky.
Yeah. So Jensen was a great. It's interesting. Jensen was not kind of tiger parented. So both his older brother and his younger brother were not especially good students. Only Jensen had this incredible drive to succeed within him for some reason. So he got perfect grades, basically. Went to Oregon State University, and there majored in electrical engineering. At the time, there was no computer science department. And at the time, you know, modern computer users are going to think about the computer from the monitor down. They're going to think about eye interface of the monitor, and then below that, their machine does something. Jensen, it's the opposite. He's thinking from the motherboard up. Mm-hmm. He understands the computer from the circuits toward the monitor, which is a different perspective. And not a lot of people have that perspective anymore. But that's how he approached computers. He was hired at AMD, designing microchips on kind of paper at first. Then he got a degree in electrical engineering from Stanford. But he really attended Stanford almost at night school. It took him 8 years to complete it. So most of his education happened in the rough and tumble world of like real world business. At 30, he started NVIDIA. So pretty young, relatively young. They almost went bankrupt a few times, kind of early in its existence. He had to pivot the company several times to survive. And really, that was his real education, right? That in Kentucky. That's where you really learn something, not so much on the drafting.
So let's go back for a second, because there are, again, some wonderful sequences in the book where we're talking about how they made the decision to leave and form NVIDIA, and what it was that LSI was refusing to do, and sort of the vision that he had of the market that they didn't have.
Yeah, so Jensen worked at a place called LSI Logic, which was a cutting-edge firm at the time in the 1980s. You would think of it as like a hot startup today. And he was in his 20s and repeatedly promoted due both to his great intelligence, his incredible work ethic, but most of all, just his appetite for risk. So he would go out to the most advanced customer he could find. They would demand this advanced microchip that no one else in the world could make. And Jensen would say, I'll do it. And then he would deliver, which was pretty incredible. People didn't think some of the stuff that he was building was possible. But he kind of started to run into corporate internal politics at LSI. And he felt that he had built this kind of division that he was running up from scratch, and he wasn't allowed to manage it. You know, he was in his 20s managing senior engineers. They were almost twice his age, and they didn't like it. So that, I think, contributed a lot to his decision to go found NVIDIA. The other thing that was happening was, at this time in the 1980s, late 1980s, early 1990s, you had the emerging video game market. Now, initially, this was like Nintendo and Sega. But there was a group of people who were like, oh, we can build this on the computer. We can build this on the PC, and a certain kind of hobbyist will be attracted to this. Now, PC video games had existed before this, but they were somewhat primitive graphically compared to what the Nintendo could do. And Jensen and his cohort were like, we can leapfrog the console makers. We can turn the PC into a better version of Nintendo. And this turned out to be true, and the market for that turned out to be much bigger than anyone expected. Now, Jensen's problem was that he's not the only person to see this. About 70 other people were trying to do this as well. So to survive, it was like the movie Battle Royale. They were all trapped on an island, and they were all trying to kill each other. And of these 70 firms, only Jensen's firm really ended up surviving, him and one other. But basically, you know, he had to kill every other firm to survive and absorb them and hire all their talent away. Jensen proved to have this very kind of what I describe as a kind of carnivorous, predatory instinct inside of himself. He actually kind of enjoyed gutting these firms from the inside. And this is what another thing that really made NVIDIA succeed. He was very ruthless.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't sound like a very easy person to work with. Sounds a bit like Ray Dalio.
It's funny. His friends describe him as this gentle, mischievous, fun-loving family man. But he goes to work and he turns on this absolutely cold-hearted business side of him. A lot of people in NVIDIA had this duality. You would talk to them, they'd seem so friendly. And then they would describe a competitive business situation, and it was just a knife fight. I mean, they're just after killing these guys, and they were completely unapologetic about it. That's business.
Not only the competitors. I mean, there are stories in the book about, you know, how he would humiliate employees who made mistakes, you know, very publicly within the company.
Yeah, this is the hard side of Jensen, right? If you messed up at NVIDIA, and you inevitably this happened to almost everybody who worked there. They would bungle some assignment, or something would come in late, something would go wrong. And Jensen would essentially make them stand up in front of the entire company and just criticize them. Brutally. He would yell at them. He would scream at them. He would deliver withering insults in front of everyone. It was very humiliating. A lot of people couldn't hack it. So there was a certain kind of person at NVIDIA who ended up being able to work there, who was able to tolerate Jensen basically humiliating them in front of a crowd. I found this aspect of Jensen a little off-putting, personally. Yeah. But the employees who worked there said that it did motivate them, and it does work to produce your best work. I was reading about the manager of Manchester United for a different story, Sir Alex Ferguson, who was maybe the most decorated association football manager of all time, the greatest soccer coach of all time. And he would do this. They called it the hair dryer. So if the hair dryer came and pointed at you, it was like getting a blast of hot air in the face as Alex Ferguson just screamed at you in front of everybody. You know, we think of Bobby Knight or maybe like Patton, these kind of leaders who need to motivate large staffs of people to do exactly what they say. And maybe screaming is a part of that. I think Greg Popovich, the basketball coach, has a reputation for this as well. And so, I don't want to condone this kind of behavior because I don't think it's very pleasant to work for. And there's probably a better way to do it. But at least inside NVIDIA, the culture, the DNA, they're screaming at each other.
I can imagine the office at NVIDIA didn't have couches and espresso machines, foosball, ping pong. I think it was pretty much just grind out the work.
Actually, actually, it did have ping pong originally because Jensen was a great ping pong player. He had started to play ping pong when he was like in his early teens and just immediately became one of the best players in the country. So Jensen loved ping pong, and he would actually thrash his employees at ping pong, and nobody could beat him. They weren't just throwing the game to the boss. Like, Jensen was unbeatable at ping pong. And they, you know, they were originally a video gaming company, so they would have a lot of video games, two consoles in the office. As the company matured, Jensen banned all that stuff because he turned it just into a place to go to work. You know, now, NVIDIA, there's no ball pit. There's no dog park. None of the amenities that you would associate with kind of a Silicon Valley company.
So I want
to go. NVIDIA is a place you go to work. I mean, that's what he says. This is a place you go to work. They do have a great espresso machine. They do have a great cafeteria, and their corporate interiors are fantastic. I mean, they look really cool. But it's a place you go to work. And there's an element in the office. They have these giant – they built two gigantic interlocking triangles, two buildings in Silicon Valley – each of which is the size of an airport, basically. And they're completely open. And Jensen sits in the middle and kind of surveys everyone working around him. And so it's kind of like a panopticon. I would find it a little challenging to work in this environment. But I think, you know, for Jensen, he's an engineer. It's all about efficiency. He's very analytical. And so this design reflects kind of his vision that everyone at NVIDIA should be, you know, putting the pedal to the floor at all times, working out of a sense, not just of a mission, but this is what Jensen really inculcates, a sense of desperation, a sense that NVIDIA is going to go bankrupt, a sense that NVIDIA is going to fail if you don't work your very hardest. And this is what Jensen brings to work every day, even when his company is the most valuable company in the world. He hasn't forgotten 1993. He hasn't forgotten when his company almost went bankrupt. When he threw out the ceremonial first pitch at the Taiwanese baseball game, he wore the number 93 on his jersey. And that was his way of saying, for me, every day is 1993. It's still day one at this company. The company was just founded and it could go bankrupt at any time. And so today, for example, NVIDIA's stock is down a lot. NVIDIA has now grown so large that they've turned into a political football.
Yeah.
And Jensen is trying to triangulate between Beijing, Taipei, and the erratic demands coming out of Washington, D.C. And so this has put him in a very difficult position. And so in some ways, this kind of desperation, the sense that NVIDIA is always at risk, it's actually true.
Yeah.
And it's more true in the microchip industry than it would be in any other industry. Microchips are like the fashion business. What you're selling completely changes every couple of years. And so you constantly have to stay abreast of the latest trends.
I want to go back to some of the early days of the companies, but and sort of leading up to 93. So the company's founded. They're going to produce this gaming chip, and it doesn't quite do everything that people wanted it to do?
Yeah, they basically had a flawed concept. Jensen's founder, Curtis Prem, had this vision to build a microchip architecture that would survive for 100 years. Prem was very brilliant, but he was a somewhat eccentric figure. And ultimately, the market just didn't like it, particularly game developers didn't like it. So the people building the video games just didn't use the circuits that he was building. And the product was a dud. It was sold to consumers. Initially, it sold quite well, but then everybody started returning it to stores to take advantage of like generous return policies. And an early company employee told me a story of going back to the stores and just seeing racks of open boxes that had been returned on the shelf. And he knew they were in trouble. So NVIDIA, after this kind of initial product launch, they had to fire about 2/3 of their staff, reduce it to a skeleton crew that worked super late nights, overtime, just trying to ship any kind of product that would give them enough breathing room. And what they settled on, and their first really successful product, was just a knockoff chip. It was just a knockoff of what other people were doing, but they got it to market so fast that they were able to get a shortcut to competition. Jensen's candor, his flexibility and his adaptability allowed him to do something I think very few CEOs would be able to do. He was able to look in the mirror and say, this product sucks, and our company isn't going in the wrong direction. And our only chance to survive is to pivot to making essentially the opposite product and then shipping it to market without pride as quickly as we can. That is the only reason NVIDIA is still here. Jensen, it was Battle Royale. It was a knife fight, and they very nearly lost a couple times, actually. They were on the brink of bankruptcy.
And what are the times they're on the brink of bankruptcy? What is the in 1993? Mm-hmm. And what is the next crisis?
The next crisis. So these chips are incredibly difficult to manufacture. And basically what you have to do is get these silicon wafers, these disks of silicon, send them off to Taiwan to have a light printing machine shoot incredibly precise lithography onto the disks. Now, what this can be compared to and what it has been compared to is standing on the moon and shooting a laser at Earth and trying to hit a quarter on the sidewalk in Arkansas. Okay? like that's how precise this has to be. And so they'd ordered, they'd taken all of their working capital and invested it in a bunch of silicon wafers to be printed. And then the printing process went wrong. And so they had a bunch of busted chips and they had no money. I mean, that was their entire working capital. So they were looking at bankruptcy once again, and they actually had to sell off a portion of their company to some of their suppliers to stay afloat. They were 30 days away from bankruptcy that time too. Then in the mid-2000s, there was another crisis where they had an accounting scandal, the SEC was looking at mm-hmm. them, and they had a deal with the Xbox. They actually made the original graphics controller on the first Xbox. But then there was kind of a clash of ego with Microsoft, and that was a falling out, and their stock price went down 90%. And then again, in 2008, their stock price went down 90% again. If you looked at the stock chart of this company, the board members compared it to the EKG of someone having a heart attack because it was just like spiking up and down all over the place. This went on for years, okay? NVIDIA was added to the S&P 500 in 2001. It actually replaced Enron, readers, the listeners will remember them. And then for 14 years, it did not go up. It was an absolute dog of the stock market. And people would make fun of it. Even the board members were like, yeah, we were like at a stagnant company. It did not have a good reputation. And Jensen had a reputation as a somewhat eccentric figure, this kind of, you know, moody guy screamed at people and kind of shipped these products that nobody seemed to want. That was then, and this is now. And now Jensen is one of the most celebrated businessmen of the era. But it took forever. I mean, it took him 25 years to get there.
But the stock is down 5.6% today. It's another dramatic day on Wall Street.
This is tariffs. I mean, this is Trump, Stuart. Yeah.
And we're going to get to that. Let's talk. I want to sort of talk about the evolution. You know, obviously, we're talking about Xboxes. And we're talking about gamers and, you know, nerdy guys in their basements who weigh 600 pounds. We're going to move into AI. But I think the trick to that, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't do we have to stop and talk a little bit about what the concept of a neural net is to understand how we make that next step?
In fact, we have to understand two things. I'll make it as simple as possible because the AI revolution is a twofold revolution. It's a complete reimagining of software and it's a complete reimagining of hardware. It is, in fact, a complete reimagining of how a computer works. And a computer worked in the same way from about 1960 to, say, 2022. And now we're completely reinventing how the computer works. So the software side is what's known as a neural net. Now, what this is a piece of software that's meant to mimic the human brain, the biological brain. And rather than kind of classic code arranged in sequence, we build a grid of artificial neurons, just like the ones in your brain, that react and have kind of like artificial synapses with the other neurons next to them. Now, people had been experimenting with systems like this going all the way back to the almost dawn of computing, the 1950s. But they'd never really been able to get them to work in a meaningful way. What changed, and the question they never really asked themselves was, what if we could just get these neurons to move a million times faster? At the same time people were developing neural nets, Jensen and his team were looking at the circuits in their graphics controllers and saying, man, these things are powerful. We should open this up. We should build a platform where science and industry can use this to kind of like do scientific research. And so they built a supercomputing platform, like a low budget supercomputing platform that harnessed the special kind of parallel computing structure of the circuits. This is called parallel or accelerated computing. And when the neural net guys ran their neural nets on this parallel computing platform, they suddenly found that it would go 1,000 times faster. And that they were delivering results no one had ever seen before. The way to think about this is a neural net in its raw state is just kind of like completely random. It has no connections. It hasn't learned anything. We have to teach it things. And that teaching process very much resembles evolution. So if you can imagine, kind of our brains are the descendants, the lineal descendants of 500 million years of evolution of neural tissue. If you go back in the fossil record and you look at like a trilobite, you'll see this tiny little thing. It's like a grain of rice. That's the first brain that appears in the biological record so far. That's kind of when it came about. 500 million years later, we have these kind of fantastic devices in our heads that can do quite a lot. Well, the neural network is very similar. It starts out in a very primitive state, and you really have to evolve it to get it to do what you want. What parallel computing, what NVIDIA's hardware can do is make evolution run thousands of times faster. It's like hyperspeed evolution, okay? So we give it a raw neural net. We give it a task we want the neural net to learn. Let's say visual recognition. This was the first task neural nets really kind of became state of the art of. So identifying pictures. Here's a photograph. What is it? It's a container ship. It's a dog. It's a golf club. And we show the neural net millions of pictures. And slowly it learns to identify these things by rearranging itself. Just as in our visual cortex, we have the ability to recognize things, not because we've personally seen millions of pictures, but because our ancestors have navigated in an environment with millions of 3D images for hundreds of millions of years. This is exactly how a neural net learns. It's like biology, and NVIDIA provides the platform to make that go way, way, way faster. Mm-hmm. That's why neural nets could never work before. They just didn't evolve fast enough, and NVIDIA built the hardware to make that happen. It's really fantastic. It's incredibly beautiful, actually, watching these neural nets evolve.
I'm sitting here. Both Kevin and I are nerdy enough to agree with you, right? That does sound like something that's beautiful. I'm not sure everyone would, but we certainly do. So, okay, let's put this in a time frame. When is this happening? When does sort of the light bulb go on for Jensen to see that this is going to be some reality? And what does he have to do to make it real?
Yeah, great question. So Jensen started building the supercomputing platform in 2003, quite a long time ago. But they didn't know it was going to be useful for AI. They actually got lucky with that. They thought that they were using it for like weather forecasting, oil prospecting, quantum physics. Like they thought they were going to find industrial scientific applications with heavy computer user needs, like supercomputing needs. But AI was a neglected field. It was actually considered a career graveyard. If you went into AI, you were throwing your career away and you would work in an academy for the rest of your life. This was 2010. This was the prevailing wisdom. And so even when the first AI pioneers, these guys, Jeffrey Hinton, Ilya Sutskever, Alex Kruzhevsky, the team in Toronto started using NVIDIA hardware to do this, they actually couldn't get NVIDIA's attention at first. It took a while for NVIDIA to start paying attention to this because AI was such a neglected field. It was not, when you look at what NVIDIA was proposing for its supercomputing platform, like 20 applications they list, AI is not on it. And it was only really around 2013 or 2014 that as Hinton's team started having these incredible breakthroughs in visual recognition that Jensen figured out what was going on. But Jensen will pivot to a good idea at the speed of light. I mean, he will be there 1 second later. And when he saw what was going on, he immediately clocked that it was the future. This is like 2013, 2014, late 2013, early 2014. So in 2013, Jensen presented at a conference, didn't talk about AI at all. 2014, 1 year later, it was all he was talking about. And he sent a message, an email to his company saying, we are pivoting the company. Just as we did all those years before, we're no longer a graphics company. Now we're an AI company. We're betting everything on AI in 2014. Wow. And even his own AI guys were like, this is like a career graveyard. Like, you know that, right? Everyone who's done this before has kind of died. And he's like, don't worry. This time it's real. I see it. And so honestly, like without Jensen doing that, I think we'd be about 10 years behind on AI. That's what Bill Dolly, the former chairman of the Stanford University Computer Science Department told me. Without Jensen, we'd be 10 years behind. He now works for NVIDIA, so he's a little biased, but I think he's right. I think it's factually true. Nobody was doing anything like this at all. And this is, in fact, why NVIDIA is so profitable and large. They were completely alone on this. Completely alone. They invented the market for AI hardware. There was no such thing before that.
Yeah.
They really built it themselves.
Steve, we've got about a minute and a half left, but I got to ask you about, did you get into a discussion with Jensen Huang at all about the threats that AI could pose to humanity, and what was his take on that?
Yeah, Jensen thinks that if you talk about threats to humanity from AI, that you are being ridiculous. Now, he's not the only person to think this. Andrew Ng is called worrying about AI. He compared it to worrying about overpopulation on Mars. I'm worried about it, though. And I remain worried about it. So I kept kind of bringing it up to Jensen. Jensen's about efficiency. And if he senses you're wasting his time, he doesn't like it. And I kind of kept asking him the same question in different ways over and over. And finally, he just exploded at me. I got the hairdryer. I got the wrath of Jensen Huang. He really screamed at me for about 20 minutes, and his PR executives were there, but they didn't interfere. It was quite the experience. I mean, it really was like just, you know, you imagine Bobby Knight yelling at you. It was just like that. And it went on for a long time. And I'm like writing this guy's biography. I mean, like, I this is my sixth interview or whatever with Jensen. Like, I was like, but it happens to everyone who gets close to him eventually. Everyone who talks about Jensen has two stories to relate. One is a time that he was so nice to them. That he was incredibly nice to them. And another was a time that he just screamed at them. So he has both of those things inside of him. It was really fascinating. It was a great part of the book.
And my guess is that this was a remarkable experience for you. The book is certainly a remarkable book. The Thinking Machine, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA, and the World's Most Coveted Microchip. We've been talking to Stephen Witt, the author. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.